Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
Glad to be talking about movies with my friends, as always.
Before we get started, I'd like to discuss Rebeller's first book, They Called Me Wyatt, by Natasha Tynes. You might remember the story of Natasha Tynes, the author who lost her book deal after Twitter's outrage mobs canceled her for tweeting a photo of a Metro employee eating on a train. After she lost her book deal, Dallas Sanier, my boss, he reached out and rescued her novel from the ash heap of history. If there's anything Rebeller stands for, it's saying no to the perpetually aggrieved. That flamethrower at the start of each show is wielded by Dallas and aimed right at the heart of phony outrage. They Called Me Wyatt is available now in paperback and on Kindle at Amazon.com and via ebook from Google. First up in controversies and non-controversies, at last, comrades, we have achieved victory! No, not over the coronavirus. No, not in the internal struggle against our waistlines, certainly not mine. Not even against Big Brother. We have never stopped loving him. I mean, of course, the fight against the corporate overlords at Warner Brothers, who are keeping the one true light away from us, that piece of art that would show us how to live in a world that hates and fears us. I speak, of course, of the Snyder Cut of Justice League, that mythical director's cut we were assured over and over again by the elites on Twitter that it didn't exist, that it couldn't exist, that it would never see the light of day, but it's real, and it's spectacular. Kind of. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen it yet. The Snyder Cut in its current form is basically just a work print. It's missing big chunks of special effects. It needs some after-dialogue recording done, all that sort of stuff. And that's why we won't be seeing it until 2021, and why Warner Brothers is spending $20 to $30 million to get it ready for HBO Max. I'll be honest, I'm biased here, as you guys know, having long argued on Twitter for the release of the film. But it strikes me as an actual absolute good, an artist getting his vision into the world, despite corporate meddling. And it's a validation of the fans who, amongst them, raised more than $150,000 for suicide awareness charities in the course of raising money to raise awareness about the Snyder Cut. Others disagree, seeing this as the worst of fandom being rewarded for their pettiness and their anger, highlighting critics who have been harangued by insults and impotent death threats from the many people on Twitter as proof that the Snyder Cut never should have seen the light of day, just on principle. Peter, what cocktail are you going to craft to drink whilst watching the greatest superhero movie never seen?
I mean, I'm just going to drink whatever you're drinking because this is a victory for Sonny Bunch. More than anything else, I think, you know, it's an important cultural moment in certain ways. It tells you something about the economics of streaming, about the ways that social media and fandom has really taken over pop culture and has become, in some ways, sort of social media fandom has become an incredibly powerful force. That's all true. It tells you a lot about the kind of the state of the expanded movie universe, where, you know, if you look back just 4 or 5 years ago, every studio was developing nothing but expanded universes. I mean, there was literally, they spent a couple of years trying to put together a GoBots expanded universe, if you guys remember even what GoBots are. Sonny does, I'm pretty sure. But no, this is in the end, this is just a victory for Sonny. You won. Like, take your victory lap.
Thank you.
And I'm going to drink whatever whiskey. I'm just going to drink Old Grandad 114 straight because I know that that's what you would approve of. And I want this to be, when I watch the Snyder Cut, which I will because I'm actually interested in watching this, I want it to be the most Sonny Bunchiest possible experience.
That's good. I'm glad that you finally acknowledged my wisdom in all things, including bourbon. Alyssa, what are your thoughts here? I was very pleased that you demanded that I write something for the Washington Post after my hiatus to get Rebeller up and running.
Almost like the fans demanded the Snyder Cut be released.
Yeah, exactly. I am.
You know what? I know what the people want. I don't need to be convinced by fan campaigns. I just know what the people want, and out of the goodness of my heart, I want to give it to them. No, I think this is interesting as a story about fandom, as you pointed out. It's also interesting as a story about business. Richard Rushfield, whose newsletter we all read, had a good installment today about the difference between launching a streaming service with something that was kind of buzzy and interesting and launching it without anything at all. And you know, HBO Max is kind of unusual in that it is rolling out without necessarily a sort of new exclusive thing to offer folks to try and encourage them to subscribe. And this rollout has been weird in a lot of ways. It's not been particularly clear which existing HBO subscribers HBO Max is going to be available to, what's going to be on it, etc. But it's absolutely the case that unlike, you know, Apple's TV efforts, which they roll out with a bunch of expensive new shows, to very little effect, I think none of those shows have particularly stuck, or even Queeby, whatever a Queeby is.
Doesn't exist. That's not a thing.
There's a show with a Hemsworth, or a movie. It's kind of a movie and kind of a show, and it's got a Hemsworth.
It's not real. There's nothing that can convince me that Quibi... Quibi is a real thing.
There was a little story on it the other day in the New York Times with Jeffrey Katzenberg, in which he was like, "Well, now that hundreds of people are using it, we have some data."
At a cost of $1.8 billion. But HBO Max doesn't really have a thing, and so as much as releasing the Snyder Cut is both the appropriate, just cinematically minded thing to do, it also just gives them something to use to sell people subscriptions, right? It's like, you know, if you don't already subscribe, like the Venn diagram of people who do not already subscribe to HBO and who desperately long to see the Snyder Cut may not be overwhelming, but it's like some overlap in the Venn diagram that they can use to sell subscriptions. And it makes sense that they need something like that. So this strikes me as both, you know, something that would inevitably, you know, pop in a news-starved cultural landscape, and that would give people some incentive to sign up for this thing. And that's kind of fun and ridiculous. And so I'm for it. I don't know if it's like brilliant business sense, but it's like pretty basic economics beyond the questions of.
Yeah, I think this is just right. I mean, like every single major producer of original content in the peak TV era, and even going back to kind of the predecessors of the peak TV era, if you think about HBO starting in the late 1990s, has launched, and if they are successful, they have been successful because they have a signature show or a signature program of some sort. They have something that creates buzz and gets talked about, even if it's, so in some cases, it's something that's very good. In some cases, it's something that's maybe not as good, but
like
gets
the Netflix adaptation of House of Cards.
House of Cards, which was not great, especially later seasons, or you can think of AMC was like the Walking Dead network for 5 or 6 years. And The Walking Dead started out kind of interesting, but was not a great show in the long run, but it was buzzy, well watched. And this goes back to the strategy that HBO had in the mid to late 1990s when they were like, we want to stand out not just as a kind of a video store, right? Like as you know, basically
not as
Blockbuster,
home box office,
right? What we want to be, we want to get a particular kind of attention that's going to drive subscriptions. And the person who was in charge of content at the time said, forget the LA critics. What I want are shows that get attention on the New York Times op-ed page. And in some ways, this is the op-ed page, right? The place where you want to get attention now is Twitter. And the best possible way, if you're Warner Brothers and own all of the DC movie universe content and own all of that stuff, the best possible way for you to get attention on Twitter right now is clearly to release and announce the release and make a huge event of the Snyder Cut.
Yeah, I mean, the business sense here is like indisputable. I mean, $20 million of special effects work that can be done remotely, that doesn't require getting everybody on a soundstage together to finish up.
It doesn't require, you know, getting a whole bunch of people on set or a soundstage or on location and spending $10 million an episode to create something from scratch that has no pre-existing brand awareness, et cetera.
Right. I mean, you're going to get way more mileage out of this than Apple did out of what was the movie with Jason Momoa? The show with Sight or Blind or
But
something?
Even like the morning show or whatever it was that they were spending $15 or $20 million an episode on. They were spending Game of Thrones
special
money.
Effects. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Entirely on like theoretically big name stars that got, I mean,
and that was in some ways not a completely stupid bet, but it was a wrong one. And what has Apple? What did Apple announce that they were doing this week? They're going to start buying back catalog material and filling out their library with older stuff. And in fact, that's the other thing that HBO Max has done is that they've bought the rights to things like Friends and some of the kind of classic 90s
South Park
television shows that just have that have huge, you know, that had you know, years long runs, a ton of episodes, and a really, really large fandom, or at least like, if not like the kind of hardcore fandom that, say, Zack Snyder has, people who will just sink hours and hours and hours and hours of time into watching Friends or Seinfeld or Star Trek or shows like that. And not all of these are shows that are going to be on HBO Max, but the streamers have invested a ton in those shows because people will spend what they want is minutes and hours of your time, and people will spend their time watching those old shows.
Yeah. Leaving aside the question of business here, I do think that this is an actual unqualified artistic good. You know, this is if you had made this argument about virtually any other director, if you were like, Ridley Scott should be allowed to show his preferred cut of The Counselor, or if you had said Wes Anderson should be able to show his preferred cut of The Royal Tenenbaums, right?
I think Wes Anderson generally gets to show his preferred cut.
Totally. I mean, but I'm just saying, like, I'm just positing, you know, if you put basically any other auteur type director in this situation and you say that this director should be allowed to have their vision seen, the people of film Twitter, the critical community, would 100% rally behind them and say yes.
Right. No one complains about Coppola's Apocalypse Now cut.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we just had a bunch of pieces about, there was a Coppola's Cotton Club, right? Got a restoration and a recut and a re-release. And nobody said that shouldn't exist. There are questions about how good it is. There's analysis of like, was this worth it? Is it any better than theatrical? Whatever, that's fine.
But it's not treated, the concept is not treated with sort of moral disdain.
Right. Right. And this is the thing I find most fascinating about this is how much of the campaign is generated by fans feeling slighted and how much of that feeling slighted is justified. And I think resentment and spite drive most things in the world at this point. But this is one of those cases where I feel like it was totally justified. Frankly,
you're speaking from personal experience about the resentment and spite driving things, huh?
I'm extrapolating from personal experience here.
But no, I mean, I think that by the time that Warner Brothers hired Zack Snyder to do these movies, they knew what a Zack Snyder movie was. And, you know, more than anything that's happened in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, like, Snyder was genuinely trying to do something kind of interesting. I don't know that he succeeded. But it's ridiculous to suggest that Warner Brothers like didn't know what they were getting into here to a certain extent, you know, sort of tonally, visually, anything else. I think that because Snyder is kind of derided as a director and not necessarily recognized as an auteur, even though he obviously is, in the sense that, you know, auteurs are people with sort of distinctive styles, lines of inquiry, etc.
Working within the studio system.
Yeah.
Like he's like almost a classic definition of an auteur, really.
Yeah. And so there is this sense that it's okay to sort of chop up his movie and there couldn't possibly be anything in there that's sort of worth seeing. And, you know, I don't know that the private contents of Zack Snyder's head inherently make for great cinema. Like, it's possible to be an auteur without being a genius, right? I mean, those two things are sort of conflated. And it's entirely possible that, you know, Zack Snyder is an auteur whose auteurism happens to be that, like, he got, you know, sort of the variety where he, like, got high after philosophy class. But that doesn't mean that it's not interesting. And I think anyone who has rooted for superhero movies to be less than just completely generic and manufacturing line assembled should be interested in this, right? I mean, if the Marvel Cinematic Universe is going to occupy multiple years of many talented young directors' lives, we should want those movies to be more interesting and those people to have more latitude. Rather than, like, it's not a high artistic good to have people subsumed into that system and sort of genericized. And look, I hope it's great. But even if it's just terrible and interesting, I'm really excited to see it because I am so bored by so much of what passes for blockbuster cinema these days, that it'll be really interesting to see what a genuinely weird version of that looks like fully realized.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so is it a controversy or a non-troversy that the Snyder Cut is being released? Hashtag released.
Non-troversy and, in fact, affirmative good.
I think it's kind of a controversy, but I also think it's a good thing. People are clearly upset about it. And in some ways, I do get why a certain type of critic is going to be grumpy about just giving stuff to fans who they don't like and who are maybe kind of obnoxious. At the same time, I'm also, even as somebody who is not a huge fan of Zack Snyder, pretty interested to see this movie.
Non-troversy. It is, in fact, an affirmative good. On to our main attraction, The Lovebirds, which hit Netflix on Friday after being pulled from movie theaters due to the coronavirus. The Lovebirds is a pretty straightforward action rom-com, I guess, if a straightforward action rom-com is a thing we can say to exist on the reg. After briefly seeing Gibran, played by Kumail Nanjiani, and Leilani, played by Issa Rae, fall in love, we jump ahead 4 years. They're living in sin, and not happily at that. Disappointed with themselves and each other, and just unhappy. They're just unhappy people. Right after deciding to break up with each other, they get involved in a hit and run that turns into murder, fleeing the scene because they suspect they will be considered the primary suspects. What follows is pretty middling, and I mean that in the nicest way possible, bit of comic action. Nanjiani and Rae are funny. The supporting cast, including Anna Camp, who I quite like, they're all entertaining. The whole thing is a tight 86 minutes, 81 with credits, and I am always up for comedies being shorter. Frankly, this is the sort of movie that never should have been in theaters in the first place. It's great background night-in fodder, but it's not gut-bustingly great. It's not wearisome either. It's hard to imagine a movie like this, frankly, ever being released in theaters again. Alyssa, how depressing is that thought?
It's pretty depressing. But I have to say, after a streak of movies that we watched for this podcast that I really have not liked, I thought this was a real pleasure. And, you know, I don't think it's a great movie. It's a silly concept and executed in sort of silly fashion. But at the same time, it's a perfect example of why chemistry between actors matters, right? Because, you know, Issa Rae and Kumail Nanjiani are the kind of actors who would not typically be cast in a big budget romantic comedy. You know, they are in this movie, they're a mixed race couple. Black women are rarely allowed to, you know, be they're not romantic comedies that star black women. They're not romantic comedies that star black women in interracial relationships. I'm generalizing a little bit here. There is, of course, like a tradition of black romantic comedy, but not one that has, you know, traditionally broken out in a huge way with mainstream audiences. But these are two people who are both extremely attractive and vibe really well together. Like that opening sequence when they're on this sort of shaggy, never-ending first date has a lot of heat and charm to it. You can see why they're attracted to each other. You know, their interplay is genuinely sort of sexy and charming. And then part of why the movie works to the extent it does is that they fight really well together. And fighting and arguing is an underrated part of romantic comedies, right? I mean,
and an underrated part of romance.
Yes, indeed. And these are people who fight well together. They have sort of all the parts of the equation.
They literally fight each other to kill the bad guy. That is the final solution in the movie. Sorry, bad choice of words. That's the movie's resolution, is that they're fighting together. They do it so well that that's what allows them to take out.
Right, and they achieve a kind of sort of harmony through fighting. And I think that, you know, chemistry is treated as a sort of nebulous quality in movie making. Some of whether you think actors have good chemistry depends on where you sit, what you're into, etc. But this is just a really nice example of how when a pair of actors genuinely click, it can elevate something. And this is a movie with a ridiculous premise. It's, you know, it's totally silly and ephemeral. But it was sufficiently enjoyable because of the two of them that I would watch it again. I also just think it has a fair number of pretty good one-liners. I mean, the whole scene where the person who they accidentally hit has then been murdered by someone else, and two sort of New Orleans hipsters discover our main characters and the body, and call in the whole thing to the police, trying to give descriptions of our heroes while trying not to sound racist, is actually a pretty good little riff on woke culture. But it's also a movie that can make jokes about sort of racism and racial profiling. This is not a great movie, but there's definitely some deft little writing going on the edges of it.
Peter, what did you think?
I watched this movie on my treadmill, on an iPad, because that is what dumping a movie to Netflix means. This was supposed to open in theaters. This was supposed to be seen on the big screen. That was the intention and expectation of the filmmakers. That was what the studio had planned. But instead, even though I have a big screen television with surround sound and a nice couch, I know I decided, I'm gonna treat this movie with kind of the way that it deserves to be treated, paying a little less attention, being a little less engaged. The movie in that format is less of an event, but that's, I think, in some ways right for this movie, which is fine, not great, and really kind of, it's cute, distracting, and sort of inessential, which makes it kind of a definitional Netflix film. You know, it has some enjoyable moments, and most of those moments, I think, I totally agree with Alyssa, are the couple here arguing with each other, being attracted to each other. They do have very good chemistry. And in fact, what I found myself wondering was, or wishing, was that this was not an action comedy with a ridiculous premise, but
it was just a human romantic comedy
about two people, a modern couple who had not decided to get married, but had lived with each other for a bunch of years, had grown apart, had separate lives after being intensely attracted to each other, and were trying to navigate that world. And all of the moments in which the ridiculous action, like they're caught up in a murder plot stuff, all of the moments in which that fades away. There's a little tiny scene at a dinner party that they're supposed to be going to, and it's not great, but it's pretty good. And you can imagine a movie that was at least pretty good, and maybe even if with some workshopping, got to great if they had just decided, if they had trusted in the concept of, this is a couple that has been together for a long time. They once were hot for each other. Now they kind of can't stand each other, and they're going to have to figure out what to do with their lives, and what to do with themselves and what that means. And that's, that's the movie that these actors wanted to be playing and are playing and do such a great job with. And it's just not the movie that the writers gave us.
And there's an actual setup for that, right? I mean, two of their close friends get engaged.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, it could be like the dinner party where that's revealed, like, sets off.
And she doesn't believe, you know, she thinks marriage is bullshit, but is just sort of supporting her friend's engagement, out of a kind of social obligation, not to be the one who's the jerk, right? It could have been an interesting movie about the kind of dynamics of modern relationships and whether marriage is actually worth it and whether it's valuable and what commitment means and all of those things. And instead, we got this just kind of occasionally amusingly silly, but just kind of ridiculous action movie premise. Like, suddenly this couple that is not quite fully believable, but isn't totally cartoony, but they found themselves in like a Bugs Bunny version of a Lethal Weapon sequel. And it's just, all of that stuff, I think, doesn't really work.
Except the scene where Anna Camp is torturing people. That's amusing.
I didn't like that at all. I just found that so cartoony, so sort of Looney Tunes dumb.
Well, it's from a totally different movie. But
yeah.
I mean, I would watch Anna Camp do anything.
I actually really like her here because I don't mind the ridiculous parts of this movie. The ridiculous parts of this movie are what make the more realistic parts work, I think, in a way, because they contrast so sharply.
I don't think I disagree with that. The movie takes a big turn at the moment that they break up and they hit somebody, and it is at that moment that the movie goes from being kind of interesting and promising to just sort of like, well, all right, they're going to have to do this stuff and I'm going to have to watch it. And it's basically going to be The Hangover, but for a couple, like just like running through a bunch of kind of zany scenes that don't make any sense
but that's all I'm looking for from a movie like this. This is what I mean when I say that it is like perfectly, it's a perfectly acceptable sort of thing to dump on Netflix because it is not looking to reinvent the wheel. I mean, in a very real way, this is extremely similar to the Happy Madison style comedies that Adam Sandler and his team are putting out.
Yes, it is treadmill comedy.
And those movies have their own place too. I actually liked Murder Mystery a fair amount. I thought it was fine. It was funny, and I like Sandler and Jennifer Aniston together. Right? I like. It's not reinventing the wheel. It is like kind of zany and put, you know, it takes a standard rom-com and puts it into, you know, something slightly different. But I like, again, it's not even that it's good or bad or whatever. I'm kind of indifferent to this sort of thing. It's not what I watch, but the idea that this sort of thing will ever be in theaters again, I can't see it. I just don't, even before the coronavirus, you know, shut everything down forever. This was sort of a like a dying breed.
And it's too bad because I think that a good romantic comedy can be a lovely collective experience, right? I mean, it's, you know, we're all so far away from being able to go to the movies together at all, whatever Christopher Nolan may think. Maybe the whole premise of Tenet is just that he's personally going to warp time so that we can go see movies in theaters again. But I digress. But going to the movies with your girlfriends is really fun, and this kind of movie that, or the kind of movie this could have been, that is sweet, kind of sexy in a way that is aimed more at women than at men, you know, that is kind of good conversation fodder, can sort of, you know, knock some things loose in your own thinking about relationships. It's like a perfect brunch movie, right? Maybe we lose those movies, and that's a loss too. You know, the version of the movie that I'm talking about is sort of a fictional, better version of this movie. But, you know, just because things aren't huge spectacles doesn't mean that there isn't a real communal value in seeing them with other people in a theater. That's a bummer. You know, I mean, I wish this movie had been better, but, you know, Spy, which is in a lot of ways a better version of this movie, and in fact very, very funny and rewatchable, you know, seeing that in a theater was fun. Watching it at home with my parents has been fun too, but, you know, not everything has to cost $200 million to buy its place onto a big screen.
I think it's notable that we keep talking about this as a romantic comedy, and that's not entirely wrong, but it's also a movie that feels afraid to be a romantic comedy. And it is really telling that the way that this movie is structured is that it starts out basically like a romantic comedy, and then as soon as you get to the inciting incident, it becomes a kind of a very low rent action movie. Like it's all of the action stuff doesn't work, I think. Because the movie is just scared of like just being a romantic comedy and just being a movie about how when people are in relationships, there's a lot of humor, even when they're breaking up. There's a lot of humor to be mined from that. It just didn't. It's like they didn't have the courage to just make a real straightforward romantic comedy. Now Netflix is making some of those at lower price points without stars, you know, with stars who are even less well known here than Issa Rae and Nanjiani, who, you know, it's not that they're not huge, not well known, but are just not like you know, not earning $25 million a movie type A-listers. But that kind of movie, it's just, it doesn't get made anymore, and producers are afraid to finance them.
Did you guys see The Big Sick, the movie?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was pretty good. Like, if I were Netflix, I'll be curious to see how this does, but I would almost hand out a small deal to the two of them to star in a series of romantic comedies because they have good chemistry. You know, they're both appealing. They have their own sort of individual followings. You know, I would like to see what they did in a Nora Ephron movie. Rest her soul. May she rest in power. But yeah, it's, I wish it, I think the fictional version of this movie in my head is one of my favorite things I've seen all year. The real thing is, it's okay.
Yeah. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Thumbs up. It's quarantine. Like, have a glass of wine. It's fun.
If I'd seen this in a theater and we weren't in quarantine, I'd give it a thumbs down. But seeing it at home, on my treadmill, on an iPad, with nothing else to watch, I'll give it a thumbs up.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right, is that we're grading on such a ridiculous curve right now that I am happy to give this a thumbs up just because it's something new and different and competent.
Well, and totally different from the big new streaming releases of the past couple of weeks. Like, it's nice to have something that's not, like, a Hemsworth-y action movie. I mean,
This movie would have been better with a Hemsworth. Every movie is better with a Hemsworth.
Who are you replacing to get that?
Actually, probably there. Mustache cop guy.
Yeah.
Like, Liam Hemsworth would be better off, or frankly, the other Hemsworth. Anyway, any of the Hemsworths would have been better.
Any Hemsworth.
There's at least three of them. I can never.
What if you could replace a bunch of characters with Hemsworths in this movie. Get rid of Mustache Cop, give him to Liam. Turn Anna Camp into Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah, that's a better movie already.
Peter has our assigned viewing for this week. Why are we watching Jean-Luc Godard's Band of Outsiders?
We are watching this film because I love it. It's Jean-Luc Godard is a kind of a seminal, important French New Wave director. And here with Band of Outsiders or Band Apart, he's made a gangster movie that is really a love story. That's also a coming of age film. It's about a trio of young, fashionable Parisians who plan and execute a robbery that unfortunately goes rather wrong. This is a seminal film in the French New Wave. It's youthful, energetic, concerned with romance and violence and the carefree joys of being a young person in a big city. But in the end, it's also sad and tragic and even melodramatic, a movie about the ways that those seemingly carefree moments of young adulthood have real consequences. You can see why I think Godard was Warren Beatty's early pick to direct Bonnie and Clyde. The movies really share a sense of youthful vibrancy, but also a sense of the tragic in it and this... And sort of a sense that violence has consequences that you don't always see until they happen. You can also see this movie's fingerprints on films for decades afterwards, from the kind of meandering philosophical conversations that would show up in Quentin Tarantino's films. Tarantino notably named his production company after this movie, to the sort of sly, hip nonconformism of Steven Soderbergh's movies, in particular the Ocean's films, which really borrow a lot from Godard and from this movie in particular. Finally, it's a movie about movies, about how cinema works and why it's powerful. Many of the French Wave, New Wave directors were critics first at Cahiers du Cinéma. I can never pronounce that right, but they had a publication that they shared together. And so they were really in tune with the formal properties of film, with the ways that ideas were embedded in and expressed by the language of shots and cuts. And you see that constantly here, particularly in the famous cafe dance sequence where the music is supposedly playing in the background of the cafe cuts in and out as they dance. They, of course, keep dancing, drawing attention to the way that the music has been added to the film. There's just a formal cleverness to this movie that I really love, especially since it manages to be both stylish and not, but without giving up on its characters. It's also just a movie about how smoking and being French and having a lot of ennui makes you look really, really cool. Alyssa, Sunny, what did you guys think of this? Had you guys seen it before?
I am interpreting this as your confession that you and Megan got together by robbing somebody's aunt. I mean, every movie you've assigned us is about how stealing money with other people just makes you really sexy.
You have to have a project. That's what romance is. Like, sometimes that project is escaping the police because you think that they're going to accuse you of murder. And sometimes that project is, you know, grand larceny. Megan and I have never robbed anyone together.
Did you guys sit on a boat, you wearing a double-breasted suit, using one of those, like, you know, pressure things to confess that you loved each other?
I mean, in fact, one of our very first dates was going to see a screening of Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight. So it's a relationship that's
Christopher Nolan
started on the right foot.
No, I enjoy... This is an interesting pairing for The Lovebirds because it is also sort of a cute movie about crime and murder. It's a much better executed one. Although one thing I would say about it, none of the three main characters really emerges as an actual person. And in part because it's sort of a less talky movie. I see where you're coming from about the sort of morality and consequences of violence. But at the same time, it's a movie that kind of undercuts that at an end. It's like, oh, we're running off to South America. We look really fabulous on this boat. I have a chicer haircut now than I used to. We're in love. Our adventures will follow. And so the sort of that.
And the victim is portrayed as having it coming for being a thief.
Yeah.
He's stealing from the government, supposedly.
Although
what that means exactly, it's never entirely clear to me.
Yeah, and this is the kind of movie that I both see its greatness and am frustrated in particular by the extent to which Odile is just kind of a doll in this movie. She's this like cute, innocent, you know, who they
would
meet
say
in English class.
Would you say she's manic?
She's not manic. I mean, she's...
Is she pixie-ish?
She's definitely pixie-ish. I mean, I'm sorry, but we meet her when she has like little pigtails and bows in her hair. You know, and again, where she's like kind of grandfathered in this sense of like wildness and desire, but she's not really a person at all. She's an inciting incident. And the movie, as much as it's charming, it feels a little hollow to me as a result.
So my problem with this movie, which I more or less like as a hangout picture, for all the reasons you guys have discussed, but my problem with it is that there's 20 minutes of plot stretched into 96 minutes of movie or so, which is, you can get away with that. I don't think Godard necessarily does here. And many of the clever filmmaking things that Peter picked up on correctly, I find annoying as opposed to clever, but this may be a function of just, you know, not being there at the time, right?
This
heart. I'm so used to this sort of thing being done now that it's not really that impressive. But like, I do find I find Godard precious in a way that like I don't necessarily find Truffaut or some of the other French filmmakers of this era. I mean, I like, for instance, I really really like Le Samurai. Which is another French crime movie that is available on the Criterion Collection, or Criterion Channel. But that's because it is like, it's an actual like kind of murder heist movie, noir, that stays that way for the entirety of its running time. This is kind of a noir with, a disaffected youth angle to it. Which again, like it's okay. It can work. I don't think it necessarily does here. It reminds me a bit of Bottle Rocket, Wes Anderson's first movie, which is another movie that doesn't entirely work for me because it is so, it's so like.
Let it be known that Peter's quietly losing his mind.
No, this is Martin Scorsese's favorite Wes Anderson film, if I remember correctly. And the first 30 minutes of Bottle Rocket, I think, are great. And I like the last 30 minutes, but it's that 30 minute stretch in the middle in the like Mexican border hotel that they kind of flee off to that does not work for me. And Band of Outsiders feels like that middle section, but for like an hour almost. That said, I still enjoy it fine as like a hangout picture. It has lots of nice scenery. It sets you in a place and a time that is very different. Even if I don't particularly care for or about any of the people in the movie, I enjoy just kind of being there with them, if that makes sense. I mean, the whole running through the Louvre thing is very, very amusing and clever. And you know, the traveling through the streets of Paris while they're basically just killing time, getting ready to go do their crimes, getting ready to go commit their crimes. That you know, it works even when I don't think it entirely works.
No, I will also say that Arthur's death scene is just so silly that I think it kind of undercuts the, you know, what's supposed to be the emotional power of the climax. Like,
Well, but that's intentionally so, yeah. Right? That shot is presaged several times through the film where the two guys do their pantomime gunning, right? Yeah. Their pantomime shooting. But Godard is making the point that what you saw before is exactly the same as what you're seeing now on film. It's just fake. They're pretending to be. And this is, again, this is one of the things I don't like about the movie, that Godard is being very, very clever. And he's like, look at the artifice. But the whole point of movies is to not see the artifice.
Well, or you, wrong. Can, have a movie that's about the artifice, or one that is, to a certain extent, like morally shocking and you know, has that moment of actual revelation. But in that particular case, you don't have both. I mean, even more than that, you have the scene where Franz and Arthur are reading through the sort of crime section of the paper and treating it as if it's sort of neutral and amusing. And then again, you know, you could have some sense of real grief. And the closest that you get to that is the moment when Odile thinks they've killed her aunt.
Well, they have. She's...
No.
She's definitely dead, isn't she?
No.
Oh, did I miss something?
She comes out of the house at the very, very end, and it is revealed that she was not killed.
No. Oh, yeah. I did miss that. Okay.
But again, like, having the decision not to have her be dead kind of undercuts it. I mean, I don't know if either of you have read The Secret History by Donna Tartt.
I love it.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite books. It's, I think, probably fortunately never been adapted for... film, because it just, it's making the leap would be very difficult. But that's a movie, that's a book that is, you know, has these characters who are kind of divorced from what it means to actually be alive, and then through a series of shocking and violent events sort of confront the fact that their actions have consequences and that they kind of can't live in this dream world anymore. And, you know, this is a movie about people who kind of get to live in their dream world because it's cinema.
But that's what movies give us. That is the delight and power of movies, is that they don't, in the end, have to come back to Earth. Now, sometimes they do.
Yeah.
But there's, I love the way that Godard kind of is constantly making us aware of the gap between cinema and real life, and he is playing with that gap, and sometimes he collapses it and sometimes he expands it, and it is about, in some ways, the distance between you sitting in your, you know, in this case, on my couch in my living room watching this movie, or in a seat at a movie theater, and what's going on the screen. And sometimes you become very immersed in it, and sometimes you're very distant from it, and it's this, right, it's this sort of push and pull between the sort of the reality that is on screen and the reality of your world. And I'm fascinated by what he is able to wring out of kind of exploring that distance. Now,
at the same time though, you know, that the choices he ends up making in the movie kind of, I don't know that it succeeds at either of those goals, right? Because you're not kind of, I don't know. I think the cutesiness of it both undermines, you know, the movie's argument about what cinema can do, because to a certain extent, I mean, by choosing to be glib, you're forfeiting some of the power of what cinema can do. And you could have a movie that, you know, has this internal sense of fantasy and that shocks the characters and you out of it. And instead, it leaves both us and the surviving characters sort of in a place of complacency and detachment, which I'm not sure I love.
Which I totally love. You're speaking my language there, French movie director. Glib complacency and like disattachment from reality.
That's the millennial way. All right, here we go.
I'm not a millennial.
You're a zennial.
There you go.
Zennial.
You're millennial, right? Adjacent.
That's true.
Assigned viewing for next week. It's up to me again. And I am picking The Way of the Gun, which is currently streaming on Amazon Prime. It is Christopher McQuarrie's first film. And as I tweeted a couple of days ago, he could put Tom Cruise on the literal moon fighting literal aliens in a real movie that we would all see one day, and nothing he does there would be better than like the first 20 or last 20 minutes of this movie. So The Way of the Gun, it's on Amazon Prime. All right, that is it for today's show. Please make sure to check out They Called Me Wyatt by Natasha Tynes, available at amazon.com. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. And remember, you can still get that 2-month free deal. We're going to just keep doing this until we open the country back up. So it might be going on for a while. Just click on that little box at the top of the homepage. If you love the show, tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we'll die. We're kind of like sharks that way. And review us at Apple. If you didn't love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. Lots of people love complaining to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch, and not just about this podcast. But I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer Dallas Sonier. Associate producer Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.